Ads, schmads. If you don't want ads, that's okay. Choose the Dave McWilliams Plus option on Apple Podcasts. And hey presto, no ads.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you doing there? It's time for the podcast. We've just had a little interprovincial bit of row criticising Munster people for being anti-Leinster.
Yeah. No, it's just...
And we all should come together and wear the green jersey, John.
Why can't we all just get on?
Exactly. John is the Rodney King of podcasting. Anyway, it is great to have you here. We are going to be discussing all sorts of things. But John, we have a little bit of an announcement. You and I are going on a podcast tour.
Well, apparently so. I've got my bus ticket and I'm raring
to go. He's got his bus pass. We're going to do a gig. Okay, so...
Go on, tell him, Mark.
So this big week, John, this week, last Thursday, the book Money, A Story of Humanity, which is the title of the book, was released to the trade press in the UK, which is great. So we've got like copies of it and they're only first draft copies. So
this book has been in the works for quite a while. We've all felt every single page.
Every single letter.
I'm delighted for you, Mac. I think that is brilliant.
No, it'll be really good. And we're going to take it on a podcast tour.
Woo!
So it's going to be published on September 11th. Which I think is quite auspicious.
This is
one day in September. September 11th is a great day. But we are going to do a gig in the...
Does it mean I have to read it?
No, don't worry. I'll tell you all about it. Don't worry. I'll give you cognos for it, okay?
Yeah, excellent.
Right? We're kicking off, John, a tour in London, South Bank.
Yes, indeed.
The Royal Festival Hall.
Yes.
No shabbiness around that?
That is superb. Do you know what, Mark? I'll just say this. On the last time... I did any sort of work in the South Bank. I was a kitchen porter.
I love it.
In the kitchens there.
Well, you have to come out. You have to announce that.
Yeah.
You have to announce that. This is the reincarnation of John Davis from kitchen porter to podcaster.
Well, as Sheena said, from sink to stage.
Oh, I like it. I like it. Anyway, so we're kicking off there. Brilliant. In London. And the following week, we're going to do a gig in Dublin. We're going to do one in Limerick. We're going to do one in Cork, one in Galway. And then I think we should go up the road to the Nordies and do one up in Belfast.
Oh, this is going to be so good, Mark.
The details will be out in a couple of weeks when we've done all the dot of the I's and cross the T's and all that sort of stuff.
But and I'll take my Xanax.
John, loads of Xanax. John will be sitting there just comatose in the corner. I'll be like Father Jack in the corner. And every now and then you just roar from the thing. Anyway, so that was a big week. That was great. And I was actually teaching in Trinity all week, which was great, which is, you know, I love doing that.
Yeah.
And the course was, again, a monetary economics course. And it was lovely. Students from all over the world. Lots and lots of shouting and roaring. Hopefully lots of listening and lots of learning. So it's been a good and very busy week, John.
Fantastic. Well, come here. Listen to me.
I'm here.
Speaking of monetary economics, did you see what happened last week as well? That your friend, Ben Bernanke.
Your friend of mine.
He released a report. He did a review of the Bank of England and their workings and how they forecast, you know, the economy and the ins and outs and ups and downs.
How they badly forecast the economy.
Exactly. And it was a bad report. They failed miserably.
They failed. It's good. There's no stars. Well, fascinatingly on that issue, we're going to come back. So today's podcast is going to be on the demise of the Economist or economics on trial or what has happened to macroeconomics,
yes,
kicked off by, as John said, a report that Ben Bernanke, the former head of the Fed, basically was commissioned to write a report of the Bank of England. And he said, he gave him a big thumbs down.
Yes.
He basically said,
yeah,
no good, must improve, must, yeah, work harder, must apply themselves more. But more interesting than that, did you see the article in the Sunday Business Post yesterday, John?
No.
Or the Business Post. It's no longer the Sunday Business Post. Mm. It was when I used to write for them.
Yeah.
They've dropped the Sunday. It's the Business Post. It was about Kilconomics and the Bank of England.
Go on. Go
it was
on.
A lovely thing, right? So Kilconomics and the Bank of England, newly published transcripts from the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England show that their top economists, when they were making decisions about interest rates in England and monetary policy and bank regulation, were actually chatting about Kilconomics and Davos with jokes.
Really?
Right? So the Business Post has got its hands...
But these are transcripts.
Yeah, and these are the minutes of the Monetary Policy Committee, right? So as you know, Kilconomics...
Brilliant.
We call it Davos with jokes. We call it Davos without the hookers, and Davos tried to sue us, so that we already got away with that, right, for a while. They tried to sue Simon Cooper of the FT for calling it Davos without the hookers. Anyway, so in 2015, so because they released these minutes years afterwards,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
The deputy governor of the Bank of England was inspired by Kilconomics. Her name was Nimat Shafiq. She's now president of Columbia University, right?
Oh,
and so herself, nice, and Mark Carney,
yeah,
the boss of the Bank of England, are making decisions about British interest rate policy, and they're talking about Kilconomics. And she's saying, look, she says, look, I was reading about Kilconomics yesterday. I started thinking, you know, maybe we should inject more humour into the MPC, the monetary policy. And she goes, my eye was stuck with a full-page ad in the Financial Times, who are still our media sponsors. Mm. And there was sessions like Hipsternomics and the Great Fall of China. And then, you know, she said, why shouldn't we introduce this sort of thinking? So Kilconomics, this is all on
this
the
is
record.
So good.
All
this
on the record.
So
Mark Carney interjects and says, listen, I was watching that too. He said, I saw the two major speakers that you were, Yanis, yeah, Varoufakis and Martin Wolf. He said the Laurel and Hardy of our profession. He should go. So Mark Carney, if you are listening...
He called Yanis and Martin Wolf the Laurel
and Hardy on the basis that they are two totally opposed characters, right?
Right.
Totally opposed. You know, Yanis would be very left.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
Martin would be very much the Financial Times, the sort of,
yeah,
the old man of economics. But the fascinating thing is
that's
there... at the Monetary Policy Committee that we're about to talk about, where decisions are being taken about the UK, yeah, economy, on high, what they're actually talking about is an economics and stand-up comedy festival called Kilconomics. All on the record.
Well, now, if that ain't a
the
compliment...
Yes.
But actually, you know, maybe they should have come to Kilconomics and learned a bit about forecasting.
Precisely, because that's what Bernanke is saying, isn't,
yeah,
he?
He said not only is the software and stuff out of date, but their staff are out of date as well.
Yeah.
And they have a really conservative way of looking at the economy. And basically, as you say, could do better,
Do better. So let's actually look at this idea of economics on trial. Because there was actually a very good Substack this week by Noah Smith called The Twilight of the Economists. And what he was saying, and you know, Noah came
he's
to Kilconomics,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah. I had a great chat with him, actually.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's a fascinating geezer.
About his rabbits.
He likes a rabbit. But he was talking about, you know, have we reached maybe 2008, 2010, peak economist and economics. So if you think for about 30 years, economists were the intellectual vigilantes of the Western world, kind of bully boys.
Mm.
Go on television, say, look, this is how the world works. And sociologists and psychologists and political theorists and journalists and commentators would all try to give their alternative views. But economists would deploy mathematics in a way...
Whip out a chart.
Yeah, in a way, yeah, that would actually... bully the others. So rather than deploying mathematics to actually elucidate and to shed light, they deployed mathematics in a way to actually bully the others into intellectual submission. And this is what I always felt, you know, as a young economist learning this trade, I could see, look, there was something going on here, which was that during the 1980s, 1990s, into the 2000s, economists seemed to have anointed themselves as my tribe with this particularly unique insight into human nature, into how the economy behaved, largely based on mathematics, And this was sufficient to bully sociologists, social theorists, political commentators into submission.
Are you guilty of that yourself, then?
A little bit, a little bit. Yeah. So this is my great confessional moment, John. This is my come to Jesus moment.
Lie down the couch there.
Lie down the couch.
Tell me how it makes you feel.
It makes me feel really bad. But it's very good to be sharing, John. I like to share, you know.
Yes, it's good.
Exactly. You know,
he's opening up.
He's opening up. This is going to be a therapeutic session for David McWilliams on behalf of himself and his tribe.
No, but what actually is interesting in what you're saying is that, and we say at the beginning of this podcast all the time, it's understanding economics. You have to understand human nature.
Yeah.
And that is one of the points that Ben Bernanke said. Yes. He said one of the mistakes of late that the Bank of England made was they predicted a year-long recession and it didn't transpire because they hadn't taken into consideration wage inflation that went along with it.
Well, and wage inflation is something you should get. I mean, these are pretty these are
but
pretty
it was
basic.
The human factor.
Well, this, I'll tell you what. So there's two things going on here. One is the human factor, and I want to talk about this. And it's kind of important to talk about this as well, because about 2 weeks ago, a guy called Daniel Kahneman passed away. He was a behavioral economist who worked with a guy called Amos Tversky. T-V-E-R-S-K-Y. Tversky died in the late 90s. They worked together as two psychologists.
Right.
And their basic idea was, hold on a second, economists have got human nature all wrong. And as a result of that, you can explain a lot of what economists got wrong through their misunderstanding of human nature. Kahneman wrote a book called Thinking Fast and Slow. We'll talk about that in a minute. And this was a different framework. Dan Ariely, these sort of guys, they're all in that school, right? That's the first thing. It's a misunderstanding of the way in which humans behave. But the second thing is also a misunderstanding of the way in which technology has changed the economy. And the economy has changed. So you take, for example, in the old days, economics would say, well, demand will go up. And over time, people will buy more stuff from shops. And this will have the impact of increasing rent, increasing the amount of employees in shops, and the multiplier effect, i.e. the amount of that money spins through the economy will be, let's say, two or three times.
Yeah.
That's fine. But what about in an online world dominated by Amazon? All that bit about the shops goes, all that bit about rents goes, all that bit about high street spending goes, because there is no high street to spend on. We're spending online. So suddenly the transmission mechanisms, which used to include all sorts of iterations in the old days, have been rendered obsolete now by technology, by an app. So what Bernanke is saying, not only do they not understand human nature, but they've also not taken into consideration all these deep structural changes in the economy, working from home, online, all these things that change two things. One is the transmission mechanism, which is basically a fancy word for the speed at which policy goes from one to the other.
Okay.
And the location of which those policies change.
So are you saying, or is Ben Bernanke saying, that at one time, the economists, they had it right, that the framework in which they were working and viewing the economy was correct? And it's the fact that the world has changed, technology has changed, and they're just still stuck in the past.
I think he's saying, first of all, economists need to get out more, is what he's saying. Right?
Right, okay.
They need to get out more. What I do, and I've always done it, I call walkabout economics. It's basically economics you pick up by walking about.
Yeah.
I call it the economics of the street. And that's the stuff that I really love. And I remember it came to me years ago, sitting in the central bank doing the economic forecasts for Ireland.
Yeah.
So we GDP forecasts every quarter. And we'd be running all these things through a big, big model and all these variables and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, coming out with these numbers. And it was basically black box, you know, basically, right? What I got, they were called.
What's that deep thought, wasn't it?
No, giga models, garbage in, garbage out.
No, but you had a deep thought from Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yes, that's the same thing.
And it comes out with the answer to life, the universe, and everything.
2 or something.
42.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It was the same sort of idea, right? So you'd have these big VAR models, VAR econometric models, right? And I'm sitting there and I'm working through all this stuff and we're coming out and it's, you know, lots of variables, lots of stats, lots of econometrics, lots of equations. And then one of the older economists looks at me and he goes, he said, what are you doing there, son? And I said, I'm doing the GDP forecasts. He said, yeah. He He said, look out there at the city. So it was in the central bank in Dame Street. So up in the sixth floor. So great view. He just says, count the fucking cranes.
Right.
So that's what he said. And he said, count the cranes. He says, that'll tell you what's going on in the economy. And what he was basically saying is, all this econometric stuff, it's all fine. But actually what you need to do is go out. He's the same fellow who said to the IMF guys,
yeah,
and they were all perplexed. Yes. Gentlemen, the laws of economics stop at Holyhead. Same guy. He just says, go out there, young fella.
He's quite insightful, that fella.
Yeah, absolutely. Count the cranes. Right, he said, because that gives you a sense of industrial activity, gives you a sense of the building trade. He was also making the point that at the time, Ireland was so heavily leveraged on construction that if there was lots of building going on, there was lots of building work, there was lots of investment, there was a lot of rents. And again, what he was just saying is, all that econometric stuff is very elegant, but it might not necessarily give you what you're looking for. So I think the very first mistake that economists made was to mistake beauty for truth. So let's have a look at that idea.
Go on.
So the beauty is in the elegance of the mathematical models. If you're into maths and these all make sense and they are all logical and they all work, and at the end you have something that looks mathematically beautiful, do not misdiagnose beauty for truth, right? Truth is what is actually happening. So in a huge part of economics has been driven by, and it's interesting, Nick Hauner said this last week, this idea of physics envy.
Yes. So
if you look, this is the, what I would call the revenge of Oppenheimer, what Cillian Murphy did to economics, right? Okay. So basically what it is, Oppenheimer comes in. And in the cult of Oppenheimer in the late 1940s and early 1950s was the cult of physics. So the reason we're making a movie about a physicist and not an economist is because physics was the material science of the 20th century. In the same way we've talked before, how biology was the material science of the 19th century.
Yes. Yeah,
so the
biggest,
like Louis Pasteur, Darwin, these were the men. And they were mainly men that changed the world in the 19th century. The great discoveries were, we talked about it before, were botany.
Yes.
Right? It was in the area of living planet, nature, this extraordinary ecosystem. So had you said who were the most consequential people, thinkers of the 19th century, they would, without a doubt, be Darwin or Pasteur.
Right.
Biologists, in a sense, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If you were asked who was the most famous thinker of the 20th century, Einstein.
Yeah.
Is clearly the most. And also, Einstein was a rock star. Like, he was famous. Like,
yeah.
He was the first famous nerd, right? If you imagine, like, you know, Einstein turned up. He was a Hollywood star. He was a public speaker. He was a moral intellectual.
Yeah.
So imagine, right?
He's a deeply flawed character.
Deeply
as well.
Flawed, but he was rock and roll.
Mm.
So people who came after him in his own area were rock and roll, Oppenheimer being one of them.
Yeah,
again,
yeah.
Deeply flawed character.
And on into Hawking as well.
Exactly. So if you were to look at who were the biggest intellectual names of the 20th century, they are physicists, right?
Mm.
And physics had the answer. So we moved from biology to physics as a general intellectual arc, right?
Yeah.
And what physics gave the world was precision. And economists thought, wow, if we can be just as precise as the physicists, we can steal a march on all these other wishy-washy social sciences out there. So they decide, okay, what we're going to do is we're going to apply physics to economics. Okay, that's grand. That makes sense. So what does that mean? Well, that means we're going to have to do a little bit more maths, maybe a lot more maths.
Mm.
Say, okay, but what else? It means we've got to make assumptions about the thing that we are looking at seen through a physics mindset. So what does that mean? Well, it means that we can say, let's say, for example, a physicist will say, if you combine that atom with this atom at this level of heat, something's going to happen.
Mm.
And we know that to be an immutable law. So the economist said, oh, great, let's, let's try and do this shit, right? So, you know, so imagine you're boiling a kettle.
Yeah, yeah.
And at a certain stage, the liquid turns into gas and the process is known as vaporization.
Yeah.
And it happens at a certain temperature all the time.
Yeah.
So economists say, oh man, could you imagine if we could create a world that looked like that? we'd then be the men in the white coats. They'd take us as seriously as they take Oppenheimer.
Yeah, okay.
But that means we're dealing with humanity. Okay, fine. And we're dealing with collective humanity. Yeah, okay, grand. Okay, well, let's make assumptions about how those people will react in different laboratory situations, like boiling a kettle.
Yeah.
So, okay, that sounds great. Fine. And then that will give us precision. So, that sounds fantastic. Let's do that, right? But the problem is that we replaced usefulness with precision, right?
Right.
Okay, so if you think of laboratories, right? If you think of simulations, right? If you think of models. So if you say to an airline pilot, John, there is a simulator machine over there, and if you go into it and you mess around with the buttons, it will simulate what's going to happen in real life.
Yeah.
So it's a worthwhile pursuit. But if you decide to take an economist and you say, you go into that little laboratory there, and we're going to simulate through this economic models a world that doesn't exist because the assumptions about humanity are absolutely off the wall and bear no relation to real people. So just imagine, that's what we did. So economics went up, it was like learning ancient Greek or ancient Latin.
Yeah.
Totally useless, right? Now, think about the mendacious, duplicitous, and harmful nature of this. So armed with the logic of physics, economists tried to bully biology.
Right.
They tried to bully human nature. And for at least four decades, which sounds mad, at least four decades, economics started to become the intellectual, what I would call vigilantes of the world. So suddenly there was do you remember that expression, the whiz kids?
Mm.
Whiz kids was an expression that JFK came up with. And JFK heard about these economists, right? Robert McNamara was one who was the foreign secretary, the American defense secretary. And JFK, it was the modern world, right? Post-nuclear world, right? And so JFK said, let's come up with the precise answer because these guys tell me they have the precise answer. And they employed whiz kids, right? One of which was Harold Malgram,
Right,
who we've had on the podcast, who's still knocking around.
And whose daughter was on the podcast just a few weeks ago.
Pippa Malcolm, right? Yeah. So Harold is one of these whiz kids. And they were employed to give precision to American public policy. So suddenly what you had was people armed with something entirely illogical, convinced politicians that they had the truth on their side when all they actually had was beauty. Mathematical beauty.
Yes.
And they misdiagnose beauty for truth. And why is that attractive? Because it gives a number, like your Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
Yeah, right?
It says, we put all this material in and we come out with a number and that awful expression, the numbers don't lie.
Yes.
But the numbers not only lied, they were entirely fallacious. And this is the economic history of the corruption of economics by very second-rate mathematicians.
But then all these policies and politics came
out of...
Are
all based on it.
Yeah.
And of course, all the politicians are bullied, because your average politician, your average TD, for example, you know...
Well, half them are lawyers, the other half are teachers.
Teachers, or whatever. Yeah. But they're trying to do good, right? They're trying... They go in, most, I think, with the best intentions, right? So you can be very cynical, but they go... But they are no match...
For the so-called expert.
For fellas like me in white coats.
Yeah.
And the worst part about me is I could also talk, which is a vicious combination.
Yeah.
If you've got the sums and the banter, you know?
Yeah.
So,
and also they have the big four as well, you know, with their credibility marching in. All that stuff.
But it's all about black box, right? So I became a sort of a renegade from this about 25 years ago when I said, hold on a second. So remember, you know, we go back to the crash. Most of the economists said, don't worry, we've stuffed the information into the black box.
Yeah, yeah.
And it has come out with a number and that number says soft landing.
Yeah.
And I thought, no, because we're dealing with humans here. And I could see our mates buying second flats and I could see our mates getting leveraged up the yin yang. And I could see our mates going, oh, I was over in Bulgaria and people were buying, you know. Yes. And I thought, hold on a second, if I have to have any future in this business, I need to deposit the black box econometric stuff here and go out to the street and see what's happening.
Yeah.
And then that's when you get into the economics of Minsky and Kindleberger and all those people, right? But again, a lot of the thinking was informed by reading Kahneman very early. Kahneman's basic idea, Daniel Kahneman, was that, John, humans make mistakes.
Yeah.
And the economist's idea was humans don't make mistakes. Kahneman says, hold on a second. We make mistakes because we deploy shortcuts. So I'll give you an example. If you go out tomorrow night, right? Or tonight, right?
Yeah.
And you meet 10 Aussies and you drink pints with Aussies, you have a laugh, they're great fun. You come back and think, all Aussies are great. I love Australians.
Okay. Yeah.
I love Australians, right? They're a great race. And you'd come back to me tomorrow and say, Jesus, Macker, Australians are fantastic people.
Yeah.
So your tiny sample of 10 people you're drinking with suddenly becomes a generalized theory. Humans do it all the time. Like my mother.
You extrapolate
the... It's heuristics, right? So my mum, for example, Alice, who you know, if Alice loses her car keys, she prays to St. Anthony.
Okay. I know this
and she
one.
Goes to pray to St. Anthony and she goes, St. Anthony, help me. Jesus Christ, the car keys. Who took them? Nobody took them. St. Anthony, right? And when she finds them, she thinks that St. Anthony found them. She thinks that it was the prayer that found the keys, when what actually found the keys was randomness. This is back to Nassim Taleb's fooled by randomness idea. So what Kahneman taught me was that we make mistakes. And then you add Minsky and psychology and group behavior, and then the common sense of the street.
Yeah.
And that leads you to what I would hope to say, John, is intellectual humility. Economists should all do a course in humility. We make mistakes. We're not right. We can't forecast human behavior. We can add to the discussion and we can give opinions, but our opinions are opinions. They're not facts.
Okay. So what Bernanke was saying, like, I know we're having a little bit of a laugh at the Bank of England, but it wasn't just the Bank of England. This is pervasive.
All the time.
But across all central banks, across the Fed, across the Irish Central Bank, the European Central Bank, they're all using the same modelling lens to predict the future.
You're absolutely right, John. You're absolutely right.
So what is then the future of economics? Like, and how do we change the model? But let's talk about that after this.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, Mark. So, in fairness, economics, fascinating subject, very useful, but doesn't paint the full picture and cannot predict. Or so we've seen. So economics has to change.
It has to change.
How does it change?
It has to change.
To become even more useful.
Well, I think that the obsession with economic modelling has to change. Because again, I come back to this idea of beauty for truth, precision for usefulness. So the charge sheet is, imagine the simulation you use doesn't really aggregate with reality.
Mm.
That's quite bad. Imagine the simulation you use not only doesn't really aggregate with reality, but actually refutes reality, gives you the opposite conclusion of what reality is likely to do. Then that's a big problem. And that's what economic modeling was giving us. It was giving us the opposite conclusion. So basically, not only was it not taking an approximation of reality, it was bastardizing reality, because its central assumption about human nature was that we are rational and we are logical and we are scientific.
Is it possible to tell
You've got to take that. No. It was possible
in a useful way. I mean, obviously.
It's possible to give a broad range of possibilities. Say, look, this is likely to happen.
Yeah.
But because of the physics obsession with precision, economists were saying GDP will rise by 2% next year.
Mm.
Now, that may sound like a small charge sheet against a profession. But if that 2 or 3% is being used for health policy, for education policy, for welfare, housing in Ireland, right? Housing in Ireland is the great example. If you get that number wrong, the ramifications on people's lives are extraordinary. So I'll give you an example. One of the most obvious developments in the past 30 years in global economics has been the rise of inequality, which is a new thing.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a new thing. It wasn't around in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. You go back and look at what economists were writing in the 70s and 80s. Was anybody talking about inequality? No, nobody. And yet inequality is what actually animates political movements. It's what aggravates societies. It's what puts people against each other. And it is actually the defining socio-demographic concept of our times, is inequality.
But was that not the result of the law of unintended consequences?
No, it was. If that was the case, that would be forgivable. But I'm going to say to you something even more unforgivable.
Right.
That inequality wasn't the unintended consequence of policy. It was the aim of policy.
Really?
So if you decide after a crash or over a period of time to reduce interest rates dramatically and keep government spending static, this is what they call the tight fiscal, loose monetary combination, which was very much the vogue for the last 25 years. What you do is you rapidly reduce interest rates, and that rapidly increases asset prices. So those people who depend on assets for their income, like dividends and shares, rents, house prices, they see their wealth increase dramatically. That is the explicit intention of policy. And at the same time, if you fix government spending, what you're doing is you are reducing the stake of those people who depend on government. Now, who depends on government more, rich people or poor people? Poor people, because government gives them education and health and all those, right? So the explicit aim of policy was to enrich the balance sheets of the already rich. Now, nobody articulated this, but this was the aim. And then the consequence of that was that the rich will spend, and that money, you'll remember this expression, will trickle down to the great unwashed.
Yeah.
That was the explicit intention of policy. Why? Because economists decided that there was one figure that made most sense. And this was the debt to GDP ratio. And they decided if that number, back to the precision, goes above a certain 90% or 100%, the whole world will end. They fed this ideology into politicians. They bullied them with mathematics. And they said, well, it's not us saying it. It's the financial markets. So then they...
Let the market decide.
So then they enlist a bunch of Yahoo sociopaths that I worked with in London, right? They are sociopaths, most traders, right? I love them. They're great fun, great to go out drinking with. But you wouldn't leave them in charge of your children, let alone an economy. I swear to God, right? But they enlist those fellas with the great weapon that is finance to bully the political class. And over time, and this goes back to Bernanke, we'll end, the graduates of this philosophical approach to the world go to school, they go to university, they get educated, they get their MBAs, they get their MAs, like me, and they go into the institutions. So you have an intellectual takeover of the commanding heights of the society by a tribe that is not only fundamentally flawed, but has been driven by jealousy of the likes of Oppenheimer and has done untold damage to millions of people's lives. See you next week.